Welcome to Diversity Central, the podcast where being woke thrives. I'm your host, Dr. William White, and today we have a special guest with a unique perspective to share. Joining us is Mr. Grant Harris, a remarkable individual and diversity professional who sought an autism diagnosis in his 30s. Welcome to the show, Mr. Harris.
Thanks, Bill. It's an honor to be here.
To start with, please share with us what led you to seek an evaluation for autism and why so late? At the age of 38, were there any specific experiences or moments that prompted this decision?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Bill. And again, it's an honor to be here to have this conversation with you and address your audience. Very humbled to be here. The short answer to that question is my wife, 100%. I would not have sought a diagnosis without her. Long story short, we've dated for many years before we were actually married. We've been married for many years. She had an inkling earlier on in our relationship that I might be autistic. She wasn't as close with my family as she is now because we weren't married yet. But she knew them. She kind of shared it with them. My family wasn't necessarily receptive to it. And we'll talk more about my family interaction later, I'm sure. But she had inkling much before we got married. And if any of your listeners know, if you're in a committed relationship and especially marriage, communication is always an issue. Sometimes it's great and yeah. There's a flow. And then other times, not so much. So we were in one of those not so much phases. And she sent me an article. And the article was something to the effect, it was a listicle, 8 or 10 common traits in your spouse or partner and that they may be autistic. And I read it. And out of the 10, 7 of them I identified with kind of strongly. And I could say maybe the 8th as well. So I've never been afraid to go to the doctor. I am not. This was at this point in time, I was in the DIA space, working in this space. So I was aware of autism in general, neurodiversity in general. I taught autistic children as a special educator at the middle school level. So I was familiar with it, but that was several years before the diagnosis. So mental health and everyone in my immediate household that's old enough to be diagnosed is diagnosed. My wife is ADHD. My daughter has battled anxiety and depression. So it's nothing new in the household. But my wife was the catalyst to my diagnosis.
Wow, that's quite a journey, my friend. Particularly, you were fortunate in that you had someone who is close to you who was able to see that there may be some issues here. Now, as a Black man in America, how do you feel your experiences and challenges related to autism might differ from those of other racial or ethnic groups?
Great question there. And there are many different sections of a person, and especially me. I like to say I'm an onion without the smell, because there's multiple layers to people, to humans, and they intersect differently. But being neurodivergent and being a Black male in America is a special kind of intersection. I have spoken with other professionals, both clinically diagnosed and self-diagnosed, who don't look like me, who don't identify as the same sexual orientation as I do, basically white females, which would be the antithesis of a Black male. And they confirm from their perspective that they can move differently and talk differently and speak differently and interact differently as an autistic person based on their race and gender differently than I can. We can dig deeper, but going through, since I have spent time in the education world, Black males coming up through the pre-K-12 education system in America are disciplined differently than other students, specifically their white male counterparts and certainly their white female counterparts. This is research that there are more in-school suspensions, out-of-school suspensions, expulsions. There are more interactions with school resource officers, which would be basically school police, with Black males than there are with other races and or genders. And many professionals that have been doing this work a lot longer than I have, and much of the research points to either a misdiagnosis or underdiagnosis in Black males, meaning that you could have an autistic middle school child that communicates differently, that doesn't always respond as soon as a teacher asks a question because their information processing is different than a neurotypical person, or they may respond in a different way with their facial expressions. Either they may have a flat facial expression in a situation where you would expect, as a neurotypical person, a vast emotional response, or the opposite. You get an emotional response where you would expect a flat, unemotional response. Because again, people who are neurodiverse, and specifically people who are autistic, their brains operate differently, and you can't always see that physically, especially in my case, readily. So these things with interaction, and you contrast that with the fact that the majority of educators in this country are white females. Somewhere between 75 and 85% are white females. And they don't always have the tools, the resources, the capabilities, the knowledge, the experience to interact with Black males, especially in inner city environments, rural environments, even suburban. All of those up and down the ladder have different experiences and how those traits manifest themselves in and outside the classroom. So me being a Black male, and I've gone through my schooling, my formal schooling, without a diagnosis, I didn't have behavioral issues, so to speak. I was never suspended, certainly wasn't expelled. But emotional and relational, always had difficulties there, interacting with people on a level where they thought was quote unquote normal. And I don't like that word for lots of reasons, even before my diagnosis. So me moving through spaces and reacting in different environments, whether they be corporate or social, are perceived different as a Black male. It can be perceived as aggressive because we have an unfounded label put on us that all Black males are somehow violently aggressive or emotionally aggressive. They're just aggressive in nature. That goes all the way back to slavery time. Or that somehow I am conceited or aloof because I am not presenting to other people in a neurotypical way. So these types of things I have experienced, and I didn't always know when I was going through it what was happening or why it was happening. But after being diagnosed and after talking to several other people in different realms than I run, there seems to be those common threads.
Well, absolutely. And thank you for introducing the whole concept of intersectionality of experience, because in this work, I don't think we do enough with intersectionality. And one of the key dimensions of diversity that you mentioned was class, middle class. And not only are the people in our field primarily white female, but they're middle class, white middle class females, which also adds a different dimension to what they're doing. The with an impressive professional background, as you have shown, including, you know, an MBA and a CDE, I'm sorry, how has your late autism diagnosis influenced or reshaped your understanding of your career trajectory or the path that you're on?
Yeah, great question. First and foremost, I want to say that I don't look at my formal disability as a disability. I see it as a capability. Mm-hmm. And seeing it as a capability has led me to do multiple things in my career, both as a professional and as an entrepreneur, that I may or may not have done before. my diagnosis. So I have been successful in my career, both as a corporate professional, as an entrepreneur, only because I've failed many times. And in my opinion, you only gain success after failure. So that's number one. And there are many more folks, and you are one of them, who are much more accomplished than me that I look up to. So in terms of how my diagnosis has helped me in my career day to day, I have higher than average information processing, higher than the average bear. Matter of fact, it's pretty stellar according to my diagnosis, which means that I process information very rapidly, and I process large amounts of information very rapidly. Information that I'm interested in, that I take a personal interest in, I absorb that very quickly. And I absorb vast amounts of it, and then I go on to that information, and I'm able to regurgitate it in different formats. So, for example, I memorized every flag of every country in the world in under 30 days because I wanted to. I challenged myself. I enjoy flags. I enjoy the history of flags, knowing where a country comes from. At that point, it was over 200 flags that I memorized. And on site, I could tell you with probably 90% accuracy, within one to two guesses, what that flag or what that country was. That's been some years ago. I could probably do 70% now. I've been off my game a little bit. But that's an example of vast amount of information that I happen to be interested in, that I absorb very quickly, and then that I can replicate or regurgitate. So in my day job, I do that a lot when it comes to writing. I'm a reader, writer, thinker. I'm a psychology major by trade. I'm a philosophy guy. I'm not into numbers. But when it comes to words, facts, information throughout time and history, I like to call them interesting facts. My family gets annoyed by me over the years because I would pull out these interesting facts from my mind palace. That's a little bit of a Sherlock Holmes comparison. He would go to his mind palace to find and solve crimes. But I'll pull it out at a random, seemingly random point in time. And not to me. To me, there's a connection. There's a dot, and then there's a dot, and someone in the middle said something, and I put those two dots together. And they're like, well, where does that come from? And I'm like, well, it comes from over here. So I would come up with these interesting facts that seem random, that most other people would not know, but they interest me. And I've been able to adjust that. I don't come up with interesting facts anymore. I just say, oh, well, did you know? And my family reacts much better to that. But the collection of these facts, the collection of this data, and the fact that it is in my head as in like a file system is different than a neurotypical person. So that has helped me in my job. That has helped me be more efficient, be more effective in the work that I do. It's helped me be more productive on a daily basis. It helps with my time management because I do lots of things, Bill, at once. I actually prefer it. A lot of people say, oh, you have too much on your plate. And this was something earlier on in my relationship with my wife, especially that she thought I had too much on my plate. And I'm like, well, no, not that I don't have enough, but I prefer having a full plate because it sharpens me. Because I have to be sure that I stay on a schedule, which I work very well in schedules. I'm very organized. I use lots of timers. I use lots of indicators that guide me and keep me on a track. But that keeps me sharp. I enjoy that environment. My wife is ADHD. She's the total opposite. She hates a timer. She hates anything that keeps her in. She understands the importance of it, but naturally she doesn't work that way. Me, I prefer that way. So I like having multiple things on my plate, doing multiple things, which has led me to all of my post-grad work. I did in a accelerated format while I was employed, working full-time, doing multiple things, doing it online, which a lot of neurotypical people, I'm not special, but a lot of neurotypical people cannot do that. Working in a different environment, and lots of people do, but out of necessity. I did it because I enjoy working that way. and because I felt like that's the best way for me to be effective and efficient. So all of my post-grad, my MBAs, my certificates were all earned while I was employed full-time, working, you know, doing it online, having a job, and then moving into having a family, which most recently led me into my book series, which we haven't gotten to yet, but I am a published author at this point, which is humbling. And we'll talk more about the book, but writing a book and writing a series of books, no less, while I'm employed and while I'm a freelancer, doing multiple things. But all of that experience and my diagnosis kind of congeals to be quote unquote successful in my corporate and entrepreneurial life.
What a wonderful explanation. It's a very, very, very inspiring perspective on embracing neurodiversity in the workplace. But also, I like the way that you began to talk about how embracing neurodiversity has impacted your family and friends. Could you expound upon that a little bit more and talk a little bit about more about how things have changed or not changed since your post-diagnosis?
Yeah, again, the older folks in my house are all neurodiverse. My wife has been diagnosed since she was a child. She's medicated. My daughter is in her formative years. She's medicated. Me, I'm grown, but I'm not medicated because I can't be, because there's no medication for autism. Mm-hmm. So I am who I am because that's the way my creator made me. But there is nothing that I can do to medically, there's nothing that I can do to smooth out or even out the wrinkles, so to speak. That has to be done emotionally, psychologically. But I can't take a pill that within a few minutes makes me more organized, like my wife. I can't take a pill that in a few minutes will make me more streamlined and focused. My wife can do that, but I can't. So what I have to do is work from the emotional perspective and work from the psychological perspective that, okay, I recognize these things. I am aware of these things. And as it gets a little bit to my framework in my book of recognizing who you are and where you are and acknowledging your intent and your impact to other people, especially to your family, and then cultivating the resources, the tools, the knowledge, ultimately to engage, and engaging is doing the work. So that's my RACE framework, RACE, in my book that I apply to my daily life is recognition, acknowledgement, cultivate, and engage. So I recognize now that, hey, I think differently, and there's not much I can do different from a medical perspective outside of talk it out, try differently, try better, put resources and tools into place. Some of them I've already expressed to you. But interpersonally, those things, well, if I'm not verbalizing, then let me write it down. And if I write it down, let me do that by text, then by pen and paper. Or let me record a message so that I can process my thoughts. Let's use a token, meaning if I'm interrupting too much, I have the token. So that means I'm speaking and the other person is listening. And then we reverse token. That means I'm listening and the other person is talking. All of these things have been tools that I've used in my interpersonal relationships to help me with my communication level to the other person in that interaction, specifically with my family. So hopefully that answers your question, Bill. But there's no magic pill that I can take to make my brain adjust to be more neurotypical. But there are things that I can do in terms of recognizing who I am and where I am, and being aware of my impact and my intent and my impact on other people around me, and cultivating knowledge, resources, tools. And gathering those things to engage, which is acting on them consistently over time.
I really did appreciate your answer here because, you know, I'm one of those guys too who always balances, you know, 100 things at one time, and I love it. I love it. And like you, my family has told me I needed to sit down and chill. And I said, no, I'm not ready to do that yet. So it's really great to hear that you're doing that. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of laughed about when you said it was that you have a token that you passed around. Well, as a leader and a manager in higher education and also in pharmaceutical companies, what I did was people always interrupted each other. So what I would do is we would throw a ball around the room and the people would catch the ball. So eventually they got tired of throwing the ball and they made me an Indian talking stick. And I still have that stick 40 years later. So it did bring a smile to my face hearing that you were made, you were able to make those kinds of changes. And I haven't even been diagnosed on the autism spectrum. A lot of my behaviors are very similar to yours. That was really inspiring. So I really did enjoy that. Shifting to your dedication to diversity, inclusion, and accessibility. Diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. And I always throw that in there. And many other people also throw in belonging. How does your lived experience as a Black man diagnosed with autism influence your approach and perspective to these initiatives?
Yeah, well, most people think about accessibility. When I started out in DEI, I focused on the DEI, which is right. Great. But a lot of people either don't understand or don't know the accessibility. And there are lots of acronyms that go out, you know, all of them, some of them that you listed. But accessibility in general, most people, if you say, well, what does that mean from a disability perspective, they would talk about access to buildings. Right. Can I get into a car? Can I get into a building? Can I get into an elevator? All of those things are real. And that is a part of accessibility. But there are other parts of accessibility from a design perspective, yes. From a technology perspective, from a place in space perspective, from a tools and resource perspective. There are multiple aspects of accessibility, just like there are multiple aspects of a person. So for me, as a Black man, I don't have in my condition, I don't have difficulty with accessing buildings. I'm a former college athlete. I'm healthy in mind, body, spirit, which I'm grateful for. So it's not that for me. My accessibility is accessibility to tools and resources that help me do my job to the best of my ability. And my accessibility is accessing places and spaces with people, with organizations. How do I get into a room? And if I am in that room or if I am at that table, how am I accepted or not? How am I addressed or not? How do I present myself? Am I comfortable? Am I psychologically safe to be in that space? And the answer to that question is no. If you read the prologue in my book, I talk more about my personal story about being the first and the only. And in my family, and at this point in my life, I have accomplished many things and I have yet to be as good as I will be. But in many spaces, I've been the first and the only. The first to do this in my family, or the only person of color and the only Black male in the room, or the only Black male in the group. And I've gotten used to that, but that's also from years of masking. And masking is a technical term that explains the phenomenon of neurodiverse people attempting to cover or change their natural behavior in order to match the behavior that society expects and that neurotypical people expect. So I've gotten very good at that in terms of masking my thoughts or my approaches, especially with my facial expressions or the lack thereof, which is a lot of times why I'm not on camera in meetings and such, because my facial expressions do not always match the words that are coming out of my mouth. And mm-hmm. My facial expressions don't always match the level of active listening that I am giving to another person who's speaking. And that is a clear trait of autistic people. So, but I have to be aware of that, especially when I'm in person with people. especially if I'm meeting them for the first time. So it takes a lot of energy, mental, physical, emotional energy for me to carry on in that fashion, which is why when I'm done with that environment, I have to recharge a lot. So that's the accessibility for me. And from a workplace culture perspective, that comes into accommodations. And accommodations are different for everybody. But as a protected class of citizen, as a disabled person, I have access to accommodations, reasonable accommodations, to help me be the most effective and efficient in my job. And that would be time management. That would be longer times for information processing. That would be access to tools that help me synthesize information faster than what I might get from just a simple recording. That also means written instructions. I synthesize information in writing much faster and much better than anything coming out of a human's mouth. So I always ask for, can you write that down? Can you bullet point that for me? Can I get it in writing? Because my brain synthesizes that information best that way. So all of these things combined are factors that are affecting me daily, even in this conversation now. But even in our conversation, as we've gotten to know each other, I had to express to you and explain to you, not that you weren't aware of, but explain to you how I interact in our personal conversations when it comes to how long I'm on video or not, et cetera. So, and I respect you. And I wanted you to understand that in terms of how I present myself in not only corporate professional environments, but also social and entrepreneurial as well.
Well, thank you for that, because, excuse me, I'm fighting allergies. Thank you for that. One of the things that that I think is really important that you mentioned was the whole concept of accessibility. And I think we'd like to, maybe in our future podcast, talk more about that, because most people just look at, as you say, the physical and not look at the systems that exclude people. So I think that's a critical concept that we need to expand upon. The other one that I've lived for over 50 years, and that is masking. As a person who has been very successful and senior management at Fortune 100 and companies and running my own business and being a dean of a university, graduate school, and the whole thing, masking was very important to my success. But it also creates some unintended damage to your psyche over time. And, you know, I know that for me, as I've gotten older, I don't mask. I am who I am. So that's a great concept. So thank you very much for bringing that up, because I think that's something that really does. People don't take into consideration when they're talking about diversity.
Well, you earned that right, Bill. You've been doing this long enough.
I've been doing it a while.
Enough to earn that right. And hopefully one day I get there as well. And it's second nature to me, but I would agree that it has unintended psychological consequences, imposter syndrome.
Yes.
Then looking at yourself and saying, is this really me, or am I just faking it till I make it to move through? And that's not moving up the corporate ladder. That's just in a conversation with anybody and say, okay. So I completely agree and understand. And when I grow up, I hope I'm like you.
Well, you're like me already. You're like me already. I hope that we have paved the road. Those of us who have come before you, African-American males in particular, have paved the road for you so that you don't have to jump through as many hoops as we had to jump through. But I really would like to expand upon that, because I would like to just have a conversation with you about how you've changed over time with the whole masking concept. And I'd be more than happy to explain to you why and how I changed, and then why I decided to go back to respecting myself and my values and everything that I needed to do to continue to be successful.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I'm happy to have we can make a whole series out of it. So I'll talk to you all day.
This is a lot of what you're saying is new to most people I know. I've already talked to folks about this, and there are people in speech pathology now who want to have a copy of this podcast or to know how to get to it. So, I mean, this crosses all barriers. Well, everything was well said. I tell you what really caught my eye is your whole concept of hashtag we not me framework, that whole framework. It caught my attention. Can you delve deeper into it? And how has your autism diagnosis played a role in shaping or reinforcing this belief in collective achievement?
Yeah, so the hashtag thing, I'm not a social media guy, but when I was thinking about it and all of that and putting it out to the world, I was like, at some point in time, I'm going to have to get back on social media and hashtag this and hashtag that. So, but the philosophy, we not me, is an umbrella term. And it really comes from a place of behavior change, and moving from a mindset of compliance, which there are folks who work in the compliance industry, but compliance in general, as a generalized definition, is ensuring that you do what you're supposed to do, how you're supposed to do it, when you're supposed to do it, where you're supposed to do it. And you do that consistently over time. And in general, there's nothing wrong with that. But in practicality, when you have that mindset of I'm only doing this because I have to, I'm only doing this because, we need to, it becomes a CYA. I like to say cover your ass phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And moving from compliance, which is based on, if you look at it from an organizational perspective, and I'm an organizational developmental guy, that's what I do, it's out of concern for the organization, meaning we check the box. We met this goal, and usually that goal is the bare minimum, and we didn't do any more because we didn't have to. So that's an I and me philosophy. Very focused on I got this done, I'm good for now, and me in terms of an organizational and driving it down to an individual perspective. When you talk about community, which gets to your point of collectiveness, community is a different mindset. It is focused on we and us, and it is not based on what we have to do. It's based on what we want to do and what we ought to do, what we should do for many reasons. So it's a different behavior. And it's not just, okay, we did this because we have to, we checked the box. It's okay, we checked the box because we're supposed to do that. We're supposed to be compliant. We're supposed to follow the law, but let's do more. Let's get to a place where we don't have to break the law in the first place. Let's get to a place where the person to your left and to your right is experiencing the level of belonging that you are in whatever space you may be in. So the we not me is really an embodiment of the mindset change from compliance to community. And that's what I talk about in my book. And I delve into that deeper. In practicality, how do you accomplish that? How do you do that in multiple different arenas as a business leader, as an organizational leader? And leaders aren't just the people with the title. A lot of times the people with the title are just managers. And we'll get into this podcast. It's not about my philosophies on organizational culture, but it affects the organizational culture because you can be a leader from any seat. And if you adopt the from compliance to community mindset, then you are moving from an area of I and me to we and us. So the we not me is a shorter way, is a mantra to embody that philosophy and that principle and those principles. And they go together hand in hand.
I really, really am excited about this whole concept of I versus we. And the reason why I bring that up is because we're living in a society today where, particularly within our political arena, it's all about I and not about we, which is really quite frightening. And I think that this is something that I'd really like to talk to you more about as it relates to your book and as it relates to how we're going to get out of this I mentality and get back to the we. We've never been totally there, but we were more there at one point than we are today. What do you think?
Agreed. I am not a politician, and I stay away from that, but this is
absolutely
America.
But I just want you to think about what's happening around you and how you can help through your book and this whole philosophy of, you know, I versus we. I think it's necessary right now.
100%. I would agree from that standpoint. And my hope is that the book and the subsequent books that are all focused on workplace culture and they build on each other help lay a foundation and a pathway and a roadmap for someone somewhere to take a step forward and be 1% better. And I'm surprised that I haven't talked about I'm full of philosophies and mantras, but 1% better is my big deal. I'm always looking every day. My personal goal is to get 1% better than I was the day before. And if you apply these principles and you apply the roadmap, and it's not going to be perfect, certainly not. You do it in your own way. But if you're getting 1% better and all of us get 1% better, then imagine the accumulative effect that could take and that could have. So, yeah, certainly. Happy to talk more about the philosophy, but that is the general idea.
What is we've mentioned your book a couple of times. Please tell us the title of your book.
Yeah, you're gonna make me self promote here, Bill.
I don't want you to self promote. I want you to just tell us what it is.
So my first book in a series of five is called Unlocking the Power of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Success. It is currently available on Amazon. It was published on November 1st. Very short highlights. I've mentioned it several times in terms of it focuses on workplace culture and how you can apply my race framework to the workplace and how you can apply the from compliance to community mindset. It's been doing very well. It's received lots of excellent ratings. It's sitting at a 4.9 out of 5 currently. It reached at its peak. It was number one in diversity and inclusion ebooks. It's currently, the last time I looked, I believe it's still in the top five and also in the top 25 in diversity and inclusion business books. So it's available on Amazon. Again, Unlocking the Power of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Success. I'm happy to send you the link and you can send that out to your audience. It's the first in a series of five. The second book is already written. That's focusing on unconscious and other types of bias. And we don't have time to talk about my feelings about unconscious bias, but there are more than just one type. So absolutely. That's number two, and that'll be published next year. And I'm in the process of working on number three as we speak, and that is focused on leadership, transformative leadership. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to get that out there. It's been a labor of love. I have to thank many people. My publisher has been excellent. The people that have been supportive of my first publication. I never thought that I was going to be an author, but I'm proud to be and very much looking forward to the other books as well.
I really do need to get back on track. A couple of the questions I'd like to ask you. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about your book. You've given us a lot of powerful information so far. One of the things that I think that many of our people in our audience would like to understand is many persons with autism describe challenges in social situations. And, you know, I've seen that myself because I've worked with people with autism. And how do you navigate these, especially considering society's biases against both race and neurodiversity?
Yeah, excellent question. I still fight. I'm uncomfortable in spaces with lots of people for different reasons. I have two ears and one mouth. I much rather listen and observe than speak. I'm doing a lot of talking here, but that's because you and your listeners want to hear what I have to say, but it's against my natural being to talk this much. And this is, you know, telling my story. But the way that I help alleviate those things is, one, obviously over time, time helps, but implementing preventative measures, meaning, so for example, if my wife and I are going to some social event, there's going to be a lot of people there. We agree on signals, physical or otherwise, if I need to step away, if I need to take a break, if we need to leave. So we will agree on some type of signal, verbal cue, that I need to step away, recharge my battery, etc. There have also been times where we'll use cues when I am showing that I am kind of done with a conversation and I am ready to remove myself, but I know that that would be rude. And I know that I can't just walk away from the person or shut the person down and say, hey, great talking to you, but I want to leave now. But my body language, which is 70% of communication, my facial expressions may be showing that, although I'm trying to not show that. It's very difficult for me. So my wife and I, there are signals or cues that we use that I say, oh, okay, this is happening. And then I have practiced ways to gracefully remove myself from conversations or situations if I feel like I'm getting anxious. I am not an anxious person, but all humans get anxious in different scenarios, and that's one of mine. I don't show it a lot. I don't get a panic attack. I can be in those spaces and places, but I have to take them at doses. Noises, different types of noises, the different types. I can drown out my kids running around me in the background and still get work done. But if a particular noise is too loud, then that is frustrating for me. And maybe someone else wouldn't even notice it. So breathing techniques, going to different places in my mind palace, using physical and verbal cues, these types of things have helped me. I don't have any tics. I know a lot of autistic people have tics. I don't believe that I do. But you can use tokens, again, having a token in the pocket or some other way where you can either rub it, handle it, squeeze it, something of that nature. These types of things help dissipate and alleviate and transfer that nervous energy or that anxiety out of the body, out of the mind, to a different inanimate object.
Excellent. Simple but powerful advice from my perspective. Sometimes we try to make it too complicated, but the fact that you and your wife and you and probably other people within your sphere help to set up signals so that you can continue to be successful. Again, that's another great example of we, isn't it?
It is, and that extends to the workplace as well.
Absolutely.
Verbalizing, one, that I am autistic, two, giving people a heads up that my facial expressions may not always match what I'm saying or may not always match what they're saying. Being open and honest about it and accepting it in the workplace is important. Now, fortunately, I have worked in workplaces that I feel comfortable enough and psychologically safe enough to do that. That's not always the case for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. However, I remind you that you are a protected class because autism is a disability and you have legal protections in an environment that you should feel psychologically safe enough to do so. And this will go on to a deeper conversation in ways that people who are not as fortunate as I am to have a team that I do that is open to that and working in this space. There are lots of things that we could talk about from a workplace cultural perspective, and I would love to be able to do that with you, Bill. But the ones that I gave were my personal experiences.
Absolutely. And I think that's great. And I think we need to continue with that conversation because, you know, I think it's a lot easier to have these folk who are supportive in your family than it is sometimes in the workplace. So I really would like to at some point talk more about that, not in this interview, but in another interview. But you brought up some interesting things in the last couple of answers. So I just want to very briefly have you answer the question. You know, I had no clue that you were on the autism spectrum. None whatsoever. You don't look like you are a person with a disability. So a lot of people who have disabilities self-identify. How do you look at that whole prospect, and how do you handle it?
Well, first and foremost, there are more people who are disabled in this country than you might think.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes.
The stats are kind of astonishing. I believe it's somewhere in the realm of one in five people in America are disabled.
For example, I'm a diabetic. I don't tell anybody because it's controlled, right? So, right. And diabetes is probably one of the largest. It is the largest and fastest growing disease in the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and so I don't self-disclose. I don't feel a need to. So how do you feel about that whole process?
I never had an issue with self-disclosure. Again, at the beginning, like I said, I look at it as a superpower. But again, I'm in this work. I do this work. I've been this way for all of my adult life. So there's a little bit of a different circumstance with me. And I have never had a mental health stigma with myself. My family was not the most accepting of the diagnosis. They basically said, you know, it was a white doctor and that's what white doctors do. I was in this, and that comes from a place and space of a different generation.
Yes.
Where they have effect. And I'm pretty convinced that other members of my immediate family have some neurodiversity, but we'll never know officially. So personally, I always looked at it as superpower. I never looked at my disability as a quote unquote disability. I look at it as a capability, but that is a testament to obviously the work that I do and the spaces and places that I'm in. And that's not always the case for most people, which is why a lot of people do not seek a diagnosis. And if they choose to self-disclose, they only do so to certain people in certain environments, which again leads to a lack of psychological safety in the workplace, which is why we need to move away from a compliance standpoint and just say, okay, well, yeah, we know, and that's it. And then that interaction and that relationship kind of stays there. It's not nurtured. It's not promoted or encouraged to talk about it, to cry about it, to hurt about it, to any of that nature. And I am autistic, and I am not the most emotional person on the planet. I have to work on my empathy. It is lacking in many different ways. And this is part of the work. But from a workplace culture perspective, I've always been empathetic that people should have the space and the opportunity and the access to talk about these things when it comes to them, because it affects their productivity at the end of the day. And productivity at the end of the day affects people's pockets.
Absolutely.
So that's how I feel about it. That's how it works for me. But I know that my personal story is not the case for most people.
Absolutely. You know, we talk about some of the challenges that people with autism have. One of them is the usage of cameras in virtual meetings. And as you know, that is becoming very commonplace. What's your perspective on this, and how do you adapt?
I am of the mind that the use of technology in general, and specifically videos on camera since the pandemic, et cetera, is set up for neurotypical people. It's set up for people that feel the need that they cannot interact or communicate with another person if they cannot see them, or if somehow the other person is hiding something, or somehow they feel uncomfortable as a neurotypical person because they can't see the other person. Me personally, I most of the time in my work life, I'm off camera. I've been with the people that I work with, the organization that I work with, long enough that people understand that. That's part of my accommodations. which is something that you should fight for in accommodations. I do not believe that you should be on camera 24/7 as a mandate, because that is Big Brother, in effect, saying, well, I need to see you and what you're doing at all times. People who are autistic, and I've mentioned it several times, they often have issues with facial expressions, matching the facial expressions of other people, whether they're listening or whether they're talking. It is physically exhausting for me. And it's also physically exhausting for neurotypical people, but me in a different way, to be on camera all day with a ring light on, to present myself in a certain way, to smile at the times that everybody else would expect me to smile, to match the energy in the room, although naturally my emotional state is flatter than a neurotypical person. But if I'm on camera, naturally as a human, I feel like that I have to match the other person's energy, match the other person's emotion. And I've tested it many times. If I'm dealing with a neurotypical person, and if I'm not on camera within the first 10 seconds, they're questioning why, what's wrong, what's that, I can't see it. And they are uncomfortable. So then therefore, I have to make them comfortable by making myself uncomfortable and masking and say, okay, I'll be on camera. I haven't been in a position with a neurotypical person, and maybe that's a challenge for me, and I'm just thinking of it now, Bill, where I say, well, hey, well, you know, how do you feel about going off camera? So we're both off camera. But a neurotypical person, I put money, and I'm not a betting man, but I put money on it that they would not go for that. And they would be extremely uncomfortable talking to a person in a virtual environment when they could not see them, when in reality, that's exactly what happens when they're talking on the phone. You can't see the person, but that's okay. But in a virtual environment, you're supposed to be on the camera. So that's a societal norm that's been set up. And personally, I attempt to not be on camera any longer than 30 minutes. I am with you, Bill, because we know each other and we've built that relationship. And this is an important conversation. But in general, I stay off camera. That gives me the opportunity to focus my energy on what is being said, not how it's being said, not who it's being said by, not the expression on the person's face, not what's happening in the background. That allows me to focus on what is being said. And I've spoken to other autistic people that have been doing this work a lot longer than I have. And there's evidence and there's research out there that neurotypical people lie more often than autistic people, which I knew that autistic people consistently, historically, are truthful and honest. I knew that much. Because they tell it like it is. They see black and white. And I used to be very black and white, but I've been married, I have kids. Now I'm gray, but I was very black and white. Autistic people, it's black, it's black. It's white, it's white. So they're very upfront and honest. Neurotypical people are not. Neurotypical people work in the gray area all the time. And they throw in shades of black and white to see how the other person is affected. And then they kind of transition and move around. So they have more propensity. I'm not calling all neurotypical people liars. That's not the case. But there is a propensity to be less truthful from a neurotypical person than there is for an autistic person. So neurotypical people need to see my face in order to react to my face to gauge their level of communication. I don't need to do that with you. I'm perfectly fine not seeing your face and having that communication, because I'm more focused on what you're saying than how you're saying it and how I can react, which all takes energy and emotion, energy away from me, mental capacity away from me, and affects my ability to have that communication, which affects my ability to do my job and make money and pay for my kids' Christmas and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how that shows up from a video capability standpoint in my life.
Well, you know, I think that's excellent information. And again, that's an area where we really have to do a lot of work. I would share with our listeners that I'm a very high energy person. I do really rely on using video and cameras, etc., and technology. And as a dean of a university, we had a mandate that all students had to have their cameras on doing an online class. And primarily because we wanted to make sure that they were there and they were attentive. But, you know, that's a societal norm that I didn't know about for years until you and I met. And, excuse me, and you and I were talking about it. And I said, well, that's not a problem. And as I told you then, and I shared with the group, with our listeners, and that is that the person that I fear the most is the person who doesn't tell me the truth about what I do. If I do something that hurts you or insults you, I need for you to tell me that, because I may keep doing it, and it will, and then I'll be labeled and unintentionally. So again, right. Thanks again. And I think that's something else we really need to talk about in a subsequent podcast. What a powerful testimony you've shared with us. Finally, what advice would you give to other Black people, or anyone for that matter, who might suspect that they are on the autism spectrum, but are hesitant to seek a diagnosis due to societal or personal fears?
Yeah, Bill, that's a big question. And thank you for this conversation as we wrap it up. One, I am certainly not a poster boy, poster person for the Black race. I do not speak for you or anyone else that considers themselves Black. Mm-hmm. I can only speak from my personal experience. I can only speak from my professional knowledge and expertise. So I don't want to speak for everyone, because every case is different. Mm-hmm. However, I would encourage all Black people and any people of any race or cultural background to pursue the knowledge about themselves that makes them the most effective and efficient person that they can be, with the tools that they were given by, in my opinion, God as a creator, to sharpen and hone those tools. You should do whatever you can to ensure that you know the most about you and how your brain, body, physiologically works in order to be the most effective and efficient person that you can be while you're on this planet. And if that involves a diagnosis, that doesn't mean that you are a broken person. That doesn't mean that you're a faulty person. That doesn't mean that there is something wrong with you. What that means is there's something wrong with society, and that society is faulty, and that society is broken, because it has led you to believe that because of who you are, then you are lesser than. And that is a systemic, at least in this culture, systemic societal issue. And you should not be made to feel less than because you are not, quote unquote, typical or normal. I prefer typical over normal. Normal doesn't exist. Normal only exists in what society deems as normal, because one day autistic people could be the norm. You don't know, you never know. So that's how I feel about that. I encourage, in whatever way, shape, or form, for anybody who is listening to this that has thought about a diagnosis, that is going through the process, that has denied the opportunity to either reconsider, to push through, to persevere, because at the end of the day, you are you, and you have to live your life. And if you have the tools, the knowledge, and the resources available equitably, then you should be able to reach your full capacity. So that's my thought on that, Bill. Hopefully that is a full and complete stance. I attempt to be clear and concise with my communication. But I would encourage anyone who's thinking about getting a diagnosis to do so, and be encouraged by my story. And I am happy to talk to anyone, any of your listeners, and we'll share contact information. I'm happy to talk to any of your listeners at any point in time to talk more about my story, the resources and tools I have at my disposal, because that's why I do this work, is to help other people, not just myself.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. This has absolutely been a mind-boggling experience. You presented me and my audience with some incredible information, and we'll talk more about providing more information with folks in the future. That's a wrap for today's episode of Diversity Central, the podcast where being woke thrives. We hope you found this conversation as enlightening and thought-provoking as I did. Mr. Harris, please share your contact information with our audience.
Yeah, it's limited. So I am on LinkedIn. You can find me, Brent Harris, on LinkedIn. You can find the book, Unlocking Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Success, on Amazon. And you can also email me directly at compliancetocommunity@gmail.com. That's compliancetocommunity@gmail.com. Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure being here.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, I will put a link to his book on this podcast site. Join us next time for more discussion on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Until then, stay curious and keep embracing the diversity that's all around you. Peace.